Thank you very much for that kind introduction. And I would like to take the opportunity to thank the organizers again for inviting me. And I have been looking very much forward to this exchange of ideas. So the prophetical books of the Bible, most prominently the books of Ezekiel and Daniel and the Revelation to John, are often characterized in expressive terms. Ezekiel, for instance, which narrates the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem and Israel's exile, a political and religious turning point in the history of the chosen people, is well known for its dark and enigmatic visions. The book of Daniel, with its explicit criticism of political power, is exegetical dynamite, as John Collins put it, and throughout the Middle Ages, it provided a model description of overthrowing rulership and the end of an empire. New Testament's book of Revelation revealed the future in disturbing visions that encompass a variety of tribulations, wars, and natural disasters the community of believers would have to endure before Judgment Day. And those who would be saved would then find justice and salvation in the heavenly city of Jerusalem, while those who were not mentioned in the Book of Life would be thrown into a fiery pit. And in the picture in the background, you can see a variety of medieval eschatological images, such as the angels and the rain of blood from Revelation. In the course of the Middle Ages, these three prophetical books provided central models for the perception of the world, for the interpretation of socio-political changes, and for the way individuals could confront their own salvation. Thus, reflections on the present and future developments of the Christian community were situated in an ongoing dialogue with the text of the Bible. Signs of the approaching end in the prophetical texts could be interpreted with a view towards specific events or persons, such as the apocalyptic peoples of Gog and Magog, the city of Babylon, or Antichrist. In the exegetical works of the 2nd and 3rd centuries, interpretations were mainly directed against Rome and its rulers, as the Christian persecutions could be seen as precursors of Antichrist. However, in the 4th century, we can observe a change in apocalyptic narratives. In the increasingly Christianized world of late antiquity, different notions of eschatology had found their way into late Roman society. Hand in hand with deliberations about the future of the Christian community, apocalyptic interpretations were integrated into the political discourse of late Roman era, in which the end of the empire became an increasingly plausible scenario. The earlier anti-Roman, anti-apocalyptic interpretations, which antagonized the empire and its rulers, were reappraised in late antique discussions about the empire's stability and in its perception of its enemies. Already at the beginning of the 4th century, in the 7th book of his Divine Institutes, the theologian Lactantius had engaged with various topics of apocalypse. For his detailed descriptions and explanations of end-time scenarios, he worked not only with the biblical prophecies of the book of Daniel and Revelation, but also integrated Roman myth and other prophetic traditions like the Sibylline oracles, trying to resolve the tension between the providence of God and the fact of Roman power. Writing during the great persecution of 303 to 313, Lactantius argued that although the Roman Empire was Christianity's worst enemy, its end should not be desired but feared, as the end times would bring even more dreadful tribulations to the Christian community than the Roman persecutions ever had. Following this line of thought, the continuing existence of the empire was then no longer connected solely to military successes or failures, but could also be regarded as a portent of the consummation of the world. These interpretations are echoed in later antique exegetical commentaries on the prophetical books. Around the year 400, there was an increased interest in these works. Christian intellectuals, renowned thinkers and church authorities such as Jerome or Augustine tried to integrate apocalyptic notions into a broader theological framework. And this was reflected in the composition of new texts, including Jerome's commentaries on Daniel and Ezekiel as well as in the re-editing, correction and updating of earlier ones, such as the reworking of Victorinus of Petovius' 3rd century Apocalypse commentary and of Tychonius' 4th century one. The reasons for this increased interest cannot only be found in the gradual Christianization of the late Roman world, but also in the political and military challenges of the time and in the need to describe and interpret them. Christian theologians and church authorities, who often involved themselves in both ecclesiastical and political affairs, tried to interpret events by means of the Bible in order to explore the religious dimension. Gothan Huns, who troubled the Roman army particularly in the decades around the turn of the 4th century, could thus be interpreted as the apocalyptic peoples of Gog and Magog of Ezekiel and Revelation, while questions about the duration of the empire could be answered according to the interpretations of King Nebuchadnezzar's dream in the Book of Daniel. A large part of these late antique discussions of apocalypse, salvation, and the Last Judgment, however, appears not in lengthy exegetical commentaries, but pops up as fragments in a variety of other genres, ranging from sermons and letters to hagiography, historiography, chronicles. Such interpretations were expressed as spontaneous reactions to alarming events, like Hesychius of Salona's question on the significance of the appearance of a comet in 418. Or they were expressed as deliberations about political change, Salviano of Marseille's admonishment concerning God's impending judgment, prompted by the devastating wars and conflicts in Gaul. Also Picisiverus' conjunction of prophetic visions and ascetic ideals, as in his works on Martin of Tours. When examining such expressions of apocalyptic thought and the efforts of contemporaries to understand the world they were living in, it becomes apparent that reality was often more complex than the straightforward parallels between, for instance, Goth and apocalyptic peoples would suggest. And this stands at the core of my research. It is my aim to connect historiography, political and religious developments, and the use of the Bible in the transformative period of the 4th to 6th centuries, in order to embed various modes of apocalyptic thought into a larger social context. In my paper today, I will follow these questions, analyzing two historiographical works which were composed at that time when the field of Christian history writing was thriving. The World Chronicle of Sulpicius-Severus, written about 400, and the Chronicle of Hydatius, composed in the 460s. I will analyze how both works built on ancient and Christian historiographical traditions, while at the same time they developed individual approaches towards history and time, integrating apocalyptic thought into their works. At the turn of the century, the Aquitanian scholar and ascetic Sulpicius Severus had already established a towering reputation as a writer. His hagiographical work on Martin, the venerated bishop of Tours, composed in 396, had not only been a resounding success, but had played a vital role in turning the bishop into a saint worthy of admiration and emulation. With this work, Sulpicius contributed an example of saintliness from the western part of the Roman Empire to the thriving field of hagiographical writing and ascetic literature. In his Dialogi, a triptych of fictional conversations between him, Martin's disciples, and members of his own ascetic circle at Primuliacum, Sulpicius portrayed the ideals of ascetic life. Between these two works, that is between 396 and 406, he started another ambitious writing project which would lead him deep into the biblical past. Sulpicius set out to write a chronicle covering the period from the beginning of the world up to the consulate of General Stilicho in 400. Sulpicius was not the only intellectual who entered into negotiations with the Christian past at that time. He started his ambitious project when Christian history writing was just about to catch on, and he was part of a wider group of late Roman Christian theologians and historians who developed a Christian interpretation of history and who appropriated the Roman Empire's past as part of the history of Christianity. Eusebius' chronicle and his church history, and especially later translations and continuations of that work by Jerome and Rufinus, played a central role in the development of a new genre of Christian historical writing. And on the slide you can see, and you all know that, but I thought an example might be a good idea, you can see the visual structure of Eusebius' chronicle, and this is from a 9th century manuscript. And the structure was laid out in parallel columns to document history as the rise and fall of mighty world empires such as Persia, Macedonia and Rome, with short entries given under each and the different models of reckoning. And the structure creates a dynamic, universal approach towards history that is easily accessible. However, from its composition in the 320s until 400, Eusebius' chronicle had not had much of an echo, as the 4th century historical writing was not a common genre among Christian authors, but rested firmly in the hands of non-Christian writers, as the monumental work of Ammianus Marcellinus testifies. And by contrast, Christian scholars engaged with the past and told history mostly by documenting the lives of holy men and women. When Sulpicius started working on his chronicle, he was part of a new development, choosing the biblical past and ecclesiastical affairs as topics for history writing. Similar to Jerome's translation and continuation of Eusebius, he built on his chronicle as well, but instead of adopting Eusebius' visual structure, he decided to write world history as a single coherent narrative. In his preface, which you can see on the slide, Sulpicius claimed that his aim was to present a condensed account of scripture. It was specifically meant for a well-educated audience and already familiar with the Bible, but hesitant to engage with the whole biblical account. Sulpicius managed to squeeze biblical, Roman, and church history into two small books of 105 chapters in total. Starting with the creation and the fall from grace, he retold key stories from the Old Testament, such as the Great Flood and the Babylonian exile, before going on to describe the early Christian communities, the Roman imperial persecutions, and Constantine as the first Christian emperor in the middle of the second book. Sulpicius' World Chronicle ends with the portrayal of two model bishops, Hilary of Poitiers and Martin of Tours, emphasizing their struggles with secular authorities and rivalries with other bishops. The chronicle concludes with a lengthy appraisal of contemporary ecclesiastical controversies in Gaul. Besides education, the central aim of the chronicle was to reveal the true biblical destiny of the world. Sulpicius wanted not only to educate his audience, but also to convince them of the fulfillment of biblical prophecies and to warn them that the end of the world was near. He approached this endeavor from two perspectives, using on the one hand the calculation of world years and biblical prophecies, and on the other, a comparison of the biblical past to the present, in order to shed light on the interlinked future development of both the Christian community and the Roman Empire. Let's turn to chronology first. Very early on in his chronicle, Sulpicius reminded his audience that 6,000 years of world history would soon be drawing to a close, and this is the first quote on the slide. He used the concept of a world week of 7,000 years as his underlying chronological structure. And this tradition combined the statements of Psalm 90 and 2 Peter 3 that a day with the Lord is like 1,000 years with the narrative of creation, Genesis, when God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. The concept of a world week does propose that the world would exist for six ages of 1,000 years each. This idea was not uncommon in early patristic literature, but not often directly connected with dates as in Sulpicius' chronicle. Crucial for apocalyptic interpretations and expectations in this respect is the calculations of the dates of Christ's birth and passion. Sulpicius placed the incarnation in the year 5500 after creation, and therefore thought that the year 6000 would coincide with 500 common era. he expected the consummation of the world to be close and imminent. Of fundamental importance for the apocalyptic interpretation of world ages were also the passages in the Book of Daniel and Revelation that suggested a literal interpretation, that after the completion of 6,000 years, Christ would return in glory and establish the seventh messianic millennium on earth. The Book of Daniel is especially important in St. Picus' Chronicle in order to understand the destiny of the Roman Empire and the future of the Christian community. This prophetical book, with its straightforward political messages about the rise and fall of world empires, provided St. Picus with a model for embedding the Roman Empire firmly within biblical eschatological history. In the Chronicle, in a long account, Sulpicius narrates the reign of the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar, starting with the siege of Jerusalem in 487 BCE. At the height of his influence and renown, the king had a dream of marvelous insight into the future, which the prophet Daniel explained to him, and this is the first quote. It is the story of the statue, consisting of different materials symbolizing different world empires, which would be eventually destroyed by stone. In Sulpicius' interpretation of Daniel, the stone symbolizes Christ. Christ would put an end to all cycles of power and history and erect a messianic kingdom. After a succession of empires, the last empire to rule was the Roman one, symbolized in the statue's feet made of iron and clay. And according to Sulpicius, it was more powerful than all the kingdoms which were before, but in his days had become weak. The reason for Rome's weakness lay for him in the fragile feet of the statue. In a mixed composition, Sulpicius saw a fitting description of the empire's present situation, and he raised the prospect of the Roman Empire, its armies, cities, and provinces becoming dominated by barbarians. However, Sulpicius' gloomy warnings about the state of the empire should not deflect our attention from the analytical appraisal of past political decisions, which underlies his interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. What he actually criticized was the deployment of barbarian rather than regular troops by the different pretenders to the throne who had put their own political interests ahead of the welfare of the empire and thus left the provinces in Gaul with little protection. Seeing that the Rhine frontier had repeatedly been stripped of troops to deal with usurpation and upheaval in Italy, Sulpicius' interpretation reflects the precarious geopolitical situation in his native Gaul. In an almost prophetic way, Sulpicius' bleak message foreshadowed the developments of the near future, set in motion by the Vandals, Swabes, and Alans' crossing of the Rhine in 4546. Sulpicius saw his diagnosis of the world's current state and its eschatological implications confirmed by Daniel's vision and prophecies. And this becomes particularly evident in the first passage on the slide, showing his belief in the literal fulfillment of biblical prophecies. Sulpicius was convinced that he was living during the 10th and last persecution, when the Antichrist, together with his precursors, barbarians and heretics, would threaten to tear apart the Christian community. And this is the second quote on the slide. For his concept of the Antichrist, Sulpicius drew upon a variety of early ideas of Irenaeus of Lyon or Victorinus of Petovio, including their interpretations of Matthew 24 or 2 Thessalonians. In these early Christian legends of Christ's final enemy, important narrative features were established, including the tradition of the Antichrist becoming a persecuting tyrant or a Jewish prophet. And it was particularly Lactantius' concept of Nero Redivivus which served as a template for Sulpicius' idea. The Emperor Nero would return and lead the 10th and final phase of the Christian persecutions as he had started the first one, and this is the third quote. In his other works, the Dialogi and the Vita Sancti Martini, Sulpicius offered more detailed information about his understanding of the imminence of the Antichrist, who, according to Martin of Tours, had already been born and would soon assume power. the final war between the forces of good and evil, as prophesied in the books of Daniel, Ezekiel, and Revelation, had already arrived according to Sulpicius. As the Roman Empire was doomed and its history drawing to a close, Sulpicius began a new chapter in the Chronicle. Starting with Constantine's reign, he told the history of the Church. But rather than ending with a vision of the Christian communities as a large, unified church, as Eusebius had, Sulpicius turned his attention towards the dangers threatening the church from within, which you can read in the first two quotes. The church was fractured by internal strife, and the communities in Gaul even more so. Sulpicius' take on the contemporary Christian church and its leaders was as unfavorable as his view of the Roman Empire. All earthly things ultimately fall into chaos, and continuous conflicts within the ecclesiastical elites about authority and orthodoxy truly come to the fore in the Chronicle's final section, which ends with a lament about the quarrels within the Christian community in Gaul, especially in the Priscillian controversy. Priscillian was a bishop in Avila who, after long conflict with fellow bishops, was put to trial by a secular ruler and not by an episcopal court, and together with six of his followers was executed in Trier, to cut a complicated story really short. And this caused violent reactions among the ascetic elites in Gaul and Spain, to whom Sulpicius can be counted as well, and the repercussions of this controversy were still felt more than a decade later, when Sulpicius was working on the Chronicle. And this prompted him to include in the Chronicle a strong statement on rulership, especially on intrusions of secular regions upon religious issues, on episcopal virtues or on the lack of them, and on ascetic leadership, using biblical examples for illustration. And the third quote on the slide is Sulpicius' interpretation of King Saul. King Saul decided to offer sacrifice to God himself, because he was anxious that his priest would not arrive in time before the battle to perform it. And Sulpicius emphasized the king's illicit presumption and let the divine punishment follow suit immediately. Sulpicius' perspective on secular power and his recapitulation of biblical events is a bleak one, clearly supporting religious over political leadership. The episodes on Old Testament kings served as exemplar for Roman emperors, whereas the priests and prophets of Israel provided models for the clergy and bishops of his time, containing moral messages and warnings for his audience. And it would have been easy for the Chronicle's audience to draw these connections, as they were acquainted with the ecclesiastical controversies and the context in Gaul. However, in the case of Priscillian, not only the emperor, but even the bishops had failed to guide and protect the Christian community in times of danger. But then, who was to do so? Sulpicius' answers given in his Chronicle was clear. Prophets, fierce ascetics, and holy men like Martin of Tours, who resisted fallible political leaders and corrupt members of the clergy, were the most suited to providing guidance in difficult times. Writing as a historian whose approach towards history was shaped by classical Roman historiography, and as an ascetic who tried to reach spiritual perfection, Sulpicius' Chronicle opened up different ways of reading and interpreting it. First of all, its stories of the past, which reflected on the present, were intended to engage, delight, and instruct a broad audience. Advanced readers could additionally read the Chronicle as an ascetic manifesto, for in his descriptions of Hilary, Priscillian, and Martin, Sulpicius constructed a new form of religious authority and leadership. Third, those who were well acquainted with Sulpicius' ascetic community or pursued a similar lifestyle could find in the text spiritual guidance and answers to questions of personal salvation. Sulpicius' use of apocalyptic imagery of the Antichrist and his precursors was not merely his theological reaction to political happenings. It was also a warning for all Christians living through what Sulpicius believed to be the time of the end. His treatment of Roman history, which was coming to an end, and of the declining power of the empire, can also be seen in the light of Sulpicius' own ascetic withdrawal from the world. The future was geared towards the arrival of a heavenly kingdom, and this was reserved for the saints like Martin of Tours, but maybe also for those who, like Sulpicius, had renounced their wealth to become servants of Christ. A slightly different approach towards time and history can be found in the Chronicle of Hydatius, written about 50 years after Sulpicius' text. Sometime in the middle of the 5th century, Hydatius, who was the bishop of the Galician town of Aquiflavia in modern Portugal, started working on a chronicle. This account, which is the only known and extant text written by him, was from the outset intended to be a direct continuation of Eusebius Jerome's chronicle, creating a monolithic compendium of about 5,670 years of world history. Starting in the year 379, with the first year of Theodosius' consulate, Hydatius picked up exactly where Jerome had left off and narrated history until the year 469. In his detailed account of the history of the Western Roman Empire, Hydatius connected Roman political history, vignettes of church history, biblical prophecies, and different systems of reckoning with each other. Unlike Sulpicius, Hydatius kept closely to the visual structure of his predecessors, with columns of year dates and short entries. Although in his continuation, Hydatius had copied Jerome's calculation, which would leave enough time for the completion of 6,000 years of world history until the end of the 8th century, Hydatius was convinced that the end of the world would take place much sooner, namely on May 27 in 482. Using Jubilees, a Jewish calculation, countdown of 50 year cycles, and another calculation system which Hydatius derived from an apocryphal text, the Apocalypse of Thomas, he was able to support his argumentation for an earlier date of the end of time. Using chronological argumentation, Hydatius' aim was not only to provide an accurate historiographical account of the Roman Empire's recent past, but also of the world's last days, which he expected were drawing closer. Having closely read the prophetical books of the Old Testament canon and having studied the apocalyptic passages in the New Testament, Hydatius concluded that God's judgment was at hand and various portents would prove its imminence. The impact of the profound political changes which had started in Sulpicius' time at the beginning of the 5th century had become apparent in Hydatius' time, and new political entities had been created. Especially in Spain and Gaul, following the movements of Vandals, Alans, and Suaves in 409 and the establishment of the Visigothic settlements in Aquitaine, the Roman Empire was confronted with changed political realities. Over the next decades, these small kingdoms increased in power, whereas the imperial authorities gradually lost their footing. Hydatius addressed these political developments from two angles. From a bird's eye view, the chronicle documents the events leading to the gradual breakdown of central political power in the Western Empire. The final entries recapitulate the joint preparations of the Western Emperor Anthemius and his eastern colleague Leo to stage a naval attack on North Africa to recover it from the control of the Vandal king Gaiseric. The chronicle's second angle reflects the political changes on a regional level at Hydatius' doorstep, telling the history of the Roman provinces of Gaul and Spain. It focuses on the continuous regional rivalries and fights between barbarian warlords, and the consequences and afflictions for the Roman population until his own days. And this second narrative strand climaxes in the Gothic invasions of Galicia and Lusitania in the 450s. In these last entries, Hydatius connects the broader perspective of the Roman Empire with regional developments in a lengthy account into which the descriptions of a number of apocalyptic signs and portents were added. Hydatius' chronicle is permeated by a discourse of apocalyptic thinking and elements of all three mentioned prophetic books, Daniel, Ezekiel, and Revelation, can be found in the chronicle, where they are used as models of interpretation to give meaning to political events. The chronicle's apocalyptic narrative starts with Hydatius' account of the invasions invasions in the years 409 and 410, which is the left entry on the slide. For the account, Hadatius drew a parallel with passages from the book of Ezekiel, the book of Lamentations, which both narrate the horrors of warfare when Jerusalem was besieged, and he uses Revelation on the opening of the fourth seal. Because not only barbarians, but the four biblical plagues of sword, famine, pestilence, and wild beasts were, quote, raging everywhere throughout the world, end quote. In Hadatius' description, contemporary events are intertwined with Old Testament history, proving that the biblical prophecies were fulfilled in his own days. The breakdown of moral values and social conventions, as exemplified in the image of mothers devouring their children, signals the end of the Roman Empire and the beginning of the end times. For describing and interpreting the political events of the next 40 years, Hadatius, similarly to Sulpicius, turned to the book of Daniel, which he integrated firmly into his historiographical narrative. Starting with the marriage of the Visigothic king Ataulf to Princess Galla Placidia in Narbonne in 414, Hadatius drew parallels to the prophecy of the king of the north and the king of the south, whose wars were central to Daniel's vision of the end times. Hadatius' interpretation was geared towards the general message of the chronicle. The end of the Roman Empire had already been set, and barbarians were playing a central role in its downfall. The book of Daniel is also explicitly quoted in the descriptions of Gaiseric's conquest of Carthage in 439, and this is the second quote, in which the Vandal rulers portrayed as the infamous King Antiochus Epiphanes, whose armies had defiled Jerusalem's sanctuary fortress and removed the sacrifices. And there are more examples, in total 14, where Hadatius drew direct allusions between biblical prophecy and recent history. These entries interpret retrospectively the conflicts between Gothic troops, Huns, and the Roman army, and the unsuccessful attempts to reconquer the African provinces in the light of biblical prophecies. They primarily relate to passages of the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, which describes the period coming before the coming of the Messiah. In the course of the chronicle, as Roman imperial authority, and especially in the provinces of Spain and Gaul, became more and more fragmented, God's presence in the world increased, and his interferences were more frequent. There are several instances where Hadatius explicitly referred to God's compassion or grace, his will, his assistance or help, or his plan. Especially in the account of 452, which features the defeat of Attila and his army in Italy, God seems to work hand in hand with the Roman army, sending divine punishment and disasters. Similar to the fading power of the Roman Empire, the fate of the barbarian kingdoms, although victorious in the beginning, is depicted as mutable and subjected to God's rule in the chronicle as well. For his apocalyptic interpretations, Hadatius did not only turn to the warring political and religious developments, he also turned his gaze to the heavens. There are 28 entries in the chronicle that refer to disastrous portents such as solar and lunar eclipses, comets, earthquakes, an aurora borealis, and a halo. Sometimes these are precisely described, stating the day of the week, the time of their appearance, and duration, as for instance a solar eclipse that occurred on Tuesday, the 23rd of December in 447. Phenomena that were chronologically distant to Hadatius' time were described in less accurate terms, and some of them were not even classified as true apocalyptic signs, but as natural occurrences. Some of them may be found in other sources, such as the famous eclipse on July 19 in 418. In general, as witnessed in the works of Ovid and Pliny, there's a long antique tradition in studying and categorizing celestial phenomena. Both Eusebius and Jerome had documented exceptional natural occurrences such as earthquakes, famines, plagues, or comets. And early medieval chroniclers writing after Hadatius would frequently add information about weather conditions, ranging from the description of a harsh winter to a rain of frogs, to news about the outcome of a battle or the death of a king. In Hydatia's chronicle, the description and the use of natural and celestial phenomena is particularly noticeable. It is striking that the concentration of these phenomena, which are clearly defined as apocalyptic signs, is relatively dense in the 450s, especially between the death of Galaplacidia in 450, which was accompanied by an earthquake, and the murder of the Roman general Aetius in 454, which was announced by an halo. And to give you an impression of the balance in the text, I've highlighted the historical and political information in black and the description of portents in orange. The entry of 451, which you can see on the slide, with the battle at the Catalonian plains, is an especially fruitful example because it links events, biblical allusions to the books of Daniel, and portents closely with each other. From the year 461 onwards until the last entry in the chronicle, 468, the portents become more pronounced, as for this period the same number of portents are documented as for the previous 81 years. In this section of the chronicle, natural occurrences were primarily defined as portentous biblical manifestations, and they always accompany or herald important events, offering at the same time the matching apocalyptic interpretation. And given the high frequency of portents for the final years of the chronicle, the structure of the text seems not only to be permeated by an apocalyptic language, but replaced by it. Instead of the description of political events with references to biblical interpretations, biblical prophecies and the description of portents form the core of these accounts in the chronicle, interrupted by news of military and political developments. Hydatia's account, the chronicle, was generated through his thorough studies of biblical prophecies, the careful observation and documentation of events, and historical methodology. The combination of these three approaches resulted in a text with a historical as well as a prophetic dimension. And here lies one central challenge for understanding the chronicle. Although Hydatia's text is a very valuable source for the history of the Spanish provinces in the 5th century, its entries always have a specific biblical dimension as well. And this makes it difficult and sometimes impossible to discern between information and interpretation, as the example of 4:9-4:10, especially about the Great Famine, has demonstrated. Arguing from a historical perspective, Hydatius drafted a Christian history from its beginning to what he believed would be its eventual biblical end, embedding apocalyptic messages into Christian historiography. Especially the chronicler's entries from 450 onwards can be read as a real-time manifestation of biblical prophecies. According to the passage in the preface, where Hydatius instructed his successors to continue his task of documenting the last days, quote, at that time at which they encounter them, he was not only expecting the end times, he was already living in the end times. And he had come to this realization gradually as he observed political events unfold around him. To conclude, whereas Eusebius and Jerome's chronicle demonstrated how the mighty and ancient kingdoms disappeared over the course of time so that the Roman Empire remained as the last world empire, Sulpicius and Hydatius narrated the empire's fate to its biblical end. While their pessimistic outlooks into the future reflected on contemporary political developments and profound changes, they also tell us how the authors positioned themselves in difficult times, how they reflected on political identity and rulership and religious identity. Neither Hydatius nor Sulpicius' apocalyptic rhetoric was solely connected to the interpretation of specific outstanding political events, but formed a commentary to the historical account. In this process, creating a dialogue between Bible and historiography. Although their approaches to the end of history seem to be quite straightforward, given that they were founded on the calculations of the end and on the tribulations that would accompany it, The added value of both chronicles lies in the intertextual approach the author take to the work. Thus, the chronicles, and particularly Hydatia's work, allow us to gain a deeper understanding into the way and observe in the 5th century thought the end of the Roman Empire and the arrival of God's kingdom would unfold. And I have arrived at the end of my presentation, and thank you very much for your attention. I'm looking forward to your questions.